Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming. Welcome to Designing Tomorrow's Digital Physical Interfaces. I'm David Merrill, and I'm the co-founder and president of Siftio, which I'll tell you a little more about in a minute. But I'm honored to be here with two friends that are doing really cool work. We have Fabian Hemmert, who's a PhD student in design research at the University of the Arts in Berlin, and Leah Beakley, who is associate professor of media arts and sciences at the MIT Media Lab. And I'm going to ask Leah to lead us off and tell me, or tell all of us, more about what she's been working on.
Great. Thanks, Dave, and thank you all for joining us here today. Let's see. Great. So as Dave mentioned, my name is Leah Beakley, and I'm a professor at the MIT Media Lab, where I run a research group called High-Low Tech. And these, I just wanted to give a shout out to my fantastic team of graduate students here. So today I wanted to talk to you about two themes that we explore in my group that relate to this issue of kind of tomorrow's kind of physical digital consumer electronic devices. The first theme that I wanted to talk to you about was materiality and materials. So one of the foundational things that we explore in my group is how we can connect the technology in our lives to the rich material world that we inhabit. And I wanted to show you and talk briefly about one project that explores this space. So for the past three or so years, we've been designing and building a series of wallpapers. And so what these are essentially giant flexible circuit boards that are made from conductive ink and paper. And so what you see here is a snapshot of one of these giant flexible circuit boards. So when they're completed, they look and feel largely like traditional wallpaper, but they also function as kind of giant input devices, but also as environmental monitoring systems and ambient displays. And then finally, they're networked so that they can communicate with all of the other devices in your life. And I wanted to just give you, play a short video that gives you a sense of the potential for this kind of new envisioning of technology through materials, and in this case, the materials of kind of paper and paint. So it just gives you a little sense of what that looks like. I should mention that there's nothing more than what you see there. So kind of what you see is what you get. All of the electronics are painted onto this sheet of paper, which is attached to the wall. And then kind of computational devices and those lights are magnetically attached to that surface, and you can move them around. And then what's happening is this is wirelessly kind of talking to a laptop in the background, which is generating the sounds and also kind of gathering information about how people are interacting with the surface and archiving that, as well as kind of gathering information about the environment, like light levels and temperature levels and so on. So that's my first theme for us to think about, materiality. The second theme is democratization. So another important area that we look at and explore in my group is how people and individuals are really shaping the landscape of technology. So one way that we're exploring this space is by designing and building consumer electronics that individuals can easily make for themselves. So new technologies like 3D printers and laser cutters and generally personal fabrication devices, along with new services like, for example, easy web access to circuit board printing, make this really possible and really easy these days. So one project that we've been doing is designing a series of open source consumer electronic devices. So we can design electronic designs, so circuit boards that can be easily reproduced through, again, kind of accessible web services. So you see a design for a simple circuit board up here in the upper left-hand corner. We can design the physical exterior of devices that can be 3D printed or laser cut. You see an example of a laser cut enclosure design up here, again, in the upper left-hand corner. And then you can see the pretty simple, straightforward construction steps that go into producing this particular piece of consumer electronics, a little set of portable iPhone speakers. So you see the soldering of the circuit board here in the upper right, and the gluing together of the enclosure, and then the final project. So then we can share those digital design files online in an open source fashion. And what happens is that other people can use them as a template and kind of remix and repurpose and kind of tinker with those designs to create their own versions of these consumer electronic products. So here's one variation where instead of kind of two separate speakers, they're integrated into a single form. So here the person is tinkering with the exterior shape of the design. Here's another and I think much lovelier example where someone has rethought kind of the material landscape of the enclosure for the speakers, and here is using bell jars to encase the electronics. This is also, I wanted to kind of conclude with this snapshot because it nicely ties back into the first theme that I introduced, how people, kind of individuals, crafting electronics in this way can incorporate and relate to the material world in all sorts of nuanced and compelling ways. So those were just two thoughts that I wanted to leave you with, and now I'll hand things over to Dave. Thank you.
Thanks, Leah. So I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about what I call hands-on digital play. Does anybody recognize this game? This is a card game, tabletop game called Rivers, Roads, and Rails that I played when I was a kid. And it is a game about making a continuous pathway of rivers and roads and rails. And I love this game because of the spatialness of it, the physicality of the cards. And now you may think that physical games and puzzle pieces like this one have, at best, some kind of ancestral relation to how we use technology, how we use computers today. Maybe they're inspirational, probably vestigial, probably obsolete, replaced by iPad apps. But today I want to challenge that. And I think the future of interactive play is actually going to be a lot more like its past than you might think, and that's a good thing. So this is Mark Weiser. He was a chief scientist at Xerox PARC, considered to be the father of ubiquitous computing, the idea that in the future we will be surrounded by lots of little computers, like painted computers on the wall, giving us delightful feedback and ways to interact. Now, one of Weiser's key ideas was that in order for this future to work, we needed to be able to interact with these computers in ways that were natural, on our own terms, in ways that human beings understand because of the way that we evolved. So with interactions like gesture and voice, basically things that we're already good at. And so one of the specific things he predicted in a 1991 paper he wrote for Scientific American was interactions at three different scales that are related to the way we interact with the world around us already. So wall or boards would be basically whole body gesture sized interactions, like the way we interact with a whiteboard or a chalkboard. And today we've got a digital form of this in the form of whole body gesture sensing, like the Kinect, like the Wii, like the CNN weather wall. And then at a medium scale, he talked about pads, which he described that would be about yay big, about the size of a book. You might interact with them by touch. Is that starting to sound familiar? Remember, this is 1991. Of course, we have the digital version of the pad in front of us. And then he described what he called tabs, which he expressed as inch-scale computers that would be scattered around on your desk and would have a lot of different uses. Now, he predicted they would be a vessel for information, kind of like a glorified USB thumb drive where you might shrink an application down onto one of these and then bring them somewhere else. But I think there's actually a lot of room for interesting, meaningful, fun, playful interactions at this scale. And the reason is people interact with things at this scale all the time. You know, from when we were a kid playing with toys, cars, play with games like dominoes, and we cut our food into little pieces, playing with marbles. You know, this is one of the scales at which we interact with the world. But why don't our computers allow us to work in this way? Why can't we play with digital things in this way? These systems, the systems that we have, don't yet capture that sensory pleasure, that timeless human goodness of little things at this scale. So I propose hands-on digital play. This is the way we have played for many years. This would have been called a social game before that word started to mean something else. But we would sit around a table and play games with other people across the table and game pieces on the surface. Now, video games are awesome because they're interactive, but they don't yet capture that classic style of play around a table with little pieces on the table. You know, I think we lose something when we're all staring at one big screen or we're buried in our own personal portable device. So when I say I want to persuade you that the future of play is going to look more like its past, that's what I'm working on at Siftio. We're building Siftio Cubes, which is a hands-on platform that brings these two play traditions together. So let me show you what they are. So we're making what we call games for intelligent play, which are basically like brainy puzzle games, tabletop games that you can feel good about. You know, no one feels like they rotted their brain playing a game of chess, and I think that's the style of play that I'm inspired by. So we built this platform of little interactive cubes, little screens that are wireless that relate to each other. When they get next to each other, they sense motion, and they can show graphics on top. And so we're truly building a game platform that's at this scale that Weiser mentioned in his paper. So we've built a bunch of different types of games, even games you can put your own content into. This is a creativity kit where you can put your own words or letters or numbers or mathematical equations in and create sequencing games. But we've explored a bunch of different ways that you can use little computers at this scale to create playful experiences. So here's a bunch more. This is based on Rummy, the card game. Exploring spaces where you can move from one cube to the other. And a bunch of other stuff. So that's Siftio Cubes. It's been fun to watch how people interact with computers at this scale. Whole families can get engaged. This was at the Maker Faire in New York City. We had these guys from MIT that started neglecting their own booth to come over and play with Siftio Cubes. That was cool. And we get beta testers of all ages. So I don't have time to show that video. But basically, in summary, you can see why I would tell you that the future of digital play will be a lot more like its past. And I think that's a good thing. So if you're a developer also, we have an SDK. So with that, I'm going to yield the microphone to Fabian Hemmert, who's going to tell you about some of the cool and wonderful things he's been building.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hello, my name is Fabian Hemmert, and I'm a PhD student, and I'm doing my PhD in Berlin at the University of the Arts at the Design Research Lab. And my PhD is all about embodiment. Embodiment is that central thought of phenomenology of how our minds and our bodies are not two separate things, but one thing. And about what embodiments means for human-computer interaction. So let me give you an example, because I'm doing my PhD in research through design. I do lots of prototypes, so you will see lots of crazy prototype videos of mobile phones. For example, we explored mobile phones that shift their shape to make the digital tangible. So we built a mobile phone prototype that can get thicker if there's more content inside and thinner if there's less. Yes, that's my job. It's a fun job. Lots of Lego involved. Okay, so it can react to the way you hold it. It can be thin in the pocket, you take it into your hand, it can like lean towards you. It's very simple. It's just four motors on the inside. It can stand next to your bed, but we can make it actually useful when we use the thickness to display digital contents and make them graspable. So, for example, often we view huge documents, PDFs or maps like here, on a small display. So we start scrolling. In this case, the thickness could show you where you could scroll. There's more content on the top left. You don't see it, but you can feel it. That's what I do. Very simple. And I like these simple interactions that make use of the abilities of, let's say, the human hand. One other thing we're really well trained in doing is sensing where an object is heavy. So could we make a mobile phone that gets heavier on one side if there's more content or something else? We tried that. We built a mobile phone that can shift its weight. So here we put the weight on two motors. It could be the battery. The battery is pretty good because it's chunky, heavy, and we can move it with the motor. So here we can display the position of the object. It doesn't really make sense because you could see it anyway. It makes more sense in situations where you can't see the display you don't want to see, like in navigation. So here the phone could guide you through the city by shifting its weight like a haptic compass, shifting the weight like ahead and left. Are you getting that? Yes, you are. Very simple. It gets heavier the way you have to walk, basically. And I like that. I like these simple things we humans can do really well, and that go a bit beyond the vibration motor. So one other thing we can do really well is empathy. Could we make a mobile phone that kind of looks like or feels like a living being? So here is the living mobile phone. So we explored putting breathing motion and a heartbeat into it. And it's calm and relaxed right now, because nothing has happened, you don't have to check it. But as soon as you have missed a call, new girlfriend, very exciting, the phone gets excited in the pocket. So how do you calm it down? What do? Any ideas? How do you get it? Ah, just scratch it behind the ears, yeah. Very simple, okay. So that's a living mobile phone. So how much time do I have left? Oh, lots of time, that's good, okay. So here's another one. Here is something that's like counterintuitive. It's a touch pen that makes it heavier to use it because we can break it. We can stop the tip from rolling. So we can make a news reader and the more important news are harder to scroll by. The pen stops from rolling. I'll think of making a signature because you're signing a contract online. If there's not much money involved, it's an easy signature, like this one. Really easy. $1. But if it's like a subscription and thousands of dollars, you have to work to make that signature. Oh, yeah. Again, it's pretty low-tech, isn't it? So, also, another nice feature is like magnetic guides and layout software. We can really make them stop. So this is like a guideline, and you're not supposed to go over it unless you really want to. And you can feel that because the pen just stops from moving over it. Quite simple, isn't it? Okay, so we do lots of prototyping with that, and here's the prototype. It's a deodorant roller, and with a servo motor and a bicycle brake. We did it together with the Hochschule für Gestaltung in Schwäbisch Gmünd. They did a really good job on developing this. Really cool, really, really simple as well, but you can feel it. Now, remember the living mobile phone. And you found it cute. And I was interested because some people found it cute, some people found it like creepy. And I want to explore that a little bit. So what we did is we tried to make mobile phone calls a bit more emotional by giving people like a sense of nearness for the other person. It looks like this. It's a mobile phone you can grasp, and the other person can feel the grasp like telecommunicated to the back of the hand. Okay. That's interesting. And people were skeptical about that. And we explored a little bit more. So we did a mobile phone that would feel, let you feel the air that's coming out of the mouth. It's going through, I have a slow motion of that. And now she's laughing, and laughing in slow motion. And she's, ooh. Oh my God. And people said, do you really want that? Realism? I mean, I can imagine a lot of people I don't want that with. And it's a crazy idea. But speaking of crazy ideas, what about moisture or liquids? Ooh. Let me show you the kissing mobile phone. And that's creepy. Okay, so she gives a kiss on the mobile phone, and it goes through. Now, how do you do that? Because technology and moisture are kind of, well, they don't go well together, we found out. And we actually use a sponge on the inside. It's a sponge that, mwah, does that. Ooh. And then people really went, Fabian, you can't do that. Sorry, I don't want ever this to happen in my mobile phone. It's just too creepy. Which is interesting, because, I mean, it's just a motor and a sponge, but it's maybe it's that kind of fake humanness that lets, oh, it gives you a shiver. And really interesting. Okay. Do you have time for more? No, maybe not. Thank you very much.
So how many of you came to this talk just to see the kissing mobile phone? Yeah. Our interfaces to computation are clearly changing. They're definitely getting better. They're getting more diverse. They're getting more embedded into our lives. To look at everyday computers, like my iPad is a huge leap in usability over the DOS-based IBM PC that I used when I was growing up. But I think we still have a long way to go, and my fellow panelists are pushing our interactions with computation in some really interesting directions. You know, we've been making tools for computation for about 50 years as humans, but we've been making tools for everything else for thousands of years. So, have we really converged? I think not. Let me kick it off with a question to Leah. What kind of materials are we going to use for making these physical, digital, hybrid objects in the future?
Yeah, thank you, Dave. Ideally, of course, the material landscape of technology should mimic the material landscape of our lives, that we should be able to interact with technology through mud and plants and carpets and water, that we can have rich, sensual material experiences along with kind of informational and computational experiences. And there are really compelling and exciting advances that are leading us in those directions. We are continually fascinated by kind of the work of chemical engineers and material scientists. So some kind of recent outputs from those spaces that we've been especially excited about and intrigued by are kind of new pneumatic systems that allow us to make completely soft and flexible robotic systems. There's some work coming out of the Whitesides group at Harvard that's really kind of beautiful and compelling along those lines. We've for quite a while been fascinated by paper and paint, and also by textiles. So there are new materials that let you make electronics kind of in those substrates. And then I think in many cases, there are lots of simple things that you can do with materials that people just haven't explored. So lots of things are conductive or resistive, for example. And there's just really a lot you can do currently with things like mud and plants, for example, that we aren't doing currently. But in short, I think there's just a tremendous landscape to be explored out there, and we're just beginning to explore and understand it.
Now, it's really exciting to think about everyday materials being part of our interactive world more and more. But if we have some computational mud, how do we know how to interact with that? What should our expectations be about? Because we know how mud works, but I don't know how computational mud works.
Yeah, so I think in many cases the most interesting path to take in interaction with materials is to use them at the interface and exploit kind of our patterns and our understandings of how to interact with materials and apply them to technology. So we want to kind of squeeze and scoop and maybe, you know, sculpt with mud. I think that's the starting place to begin when thinking about kind of how, what kind of role it could play in our computational lives. I mean, so the wallpaper project that I showed is an example along these lines. So what we did is we took a traditional thing that we do with paper, and we mapped some technology onto that. And I think it actually opens up a pretty interesting and rich space of potential applications.
So one of the questions we talked about among the panel beforehand was, what kind of new affordances can we expect our devices to provide in 10 years or 15 years? And so I'd like to put this question to Fabian. What do you think? What are our devices? I mean, it sounds... you've already obviously pointed the way towards some pretty interesting new ways to interact. But what do you think, where does that lead?
So if we think about what happens in 10 years, we could like look at what happened 10 years before and 10 years before that. And it's kind of the shift from symbolic, textual information dialogue. You know, the computer displays something, I read it, I respond by typing something in. 10 years later, graphical user interfaces. It's getting more... I mean, if you have a picture on the screen, the representation is clearly more similar to what you're used to from your everyday life. It's less symbolic, it's more concrete. And then 10 years later, like now, we have everydayness in the interaction, basically. You don't think too much about doing gestures with a mobile phone. It's pretty intuitive. So it's more getting more everyday-like, which is a good thing, I think. And also, I see that the role of our bodies is dramatically growing. With the Kinect, it's like... I mean, like 5 years from now, in the past, you were like working all day on the computer, and in the evening you had to go to the gym, because even though you worked all day, it didn't like use the body at all. And I think we have bodily skills that we can use, and I think that will be very important in the future as well, using the body, feeling rather than thinking. Maybe that's the thing.
So this sounds like kind of a stupid question, but like what's the craziest way you'd like to use the body?
So what I would love to do, I mean, you see what I do right now, it's like talking to the sensors, and some sensors I would like to experiment with is like equilibrium, feeling like gravity, and maybe hunger. Like, oh, I'm so stuffed, all these tweets today, or I'm hungry for information. That would be crazy. Not sure how to do it. Yeah.
Any thoughts, Leah, about... affordances?
So actually recently I've been introduced to the work of a researcher named Alvaro Casanelli, who is a researcher in Japan, and he's spoken really wonderfully about kind of the sense of space that our body occupies, and imagining if I could have the sense of space that, you know, my body is kind of the walls of this room or something. We can imagine what that would feel like, but wouldn't it be cool to invent technologies that would really kind of give us that those kinds of experiences? That's been something that I've been intrigued with recently.
Are those called drugs?
Perhaps.
All right, let me change the topic a little bit. Now, this is something, your work, Leah, is in the very much part of the DIY movement, maker movement, empowering people to do their own stuff. Where do you see craft electronics, if I could call it that, in relation to the consumer electronics industry? Does it happily live alongside it as a growing movement? Does it eventually overthrow the industry? What can we expect?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, and there's a really interesting landscape there. What I see right now is that we're on the cusp of kind of a democratization of product design that's going to look and feel really similar to the democratization of kind of media design that we're in the middle of right now. So it's increasingly possible for people to design and build their own products in the way that kind of 10 years ago it was increasingly possible for people to design and create their own media. And I think in many ways those landscapes are going to look similar. So in the realm of products, I don't think we're going to eliminate traditional product outlets or traditional kind of models of production. But what we're going to see is this vibrant alternative space that's characterized by wild diversity. So some stuff that comes out of there is going to look a lot like professionally developed and manufactured products. Some is going to look really amateurish but be kind of funny and whimsical and wild. Some of it maybe just won't be interesting at all, except maybe to one or two people and those people's friends. But you're going to see, I think, this rich, kind of diverse space evolve. So that's kind of the first characterization. I think we could keep talking about this landscape, though. There are some striking differences as well. One is that it's much easier to sell a physical product than it is to sell a piece of media. So that will necessitate that these landscapes take on really different characters. Another is that it's harder to make a physical product than it is, in many cases, to make a piece of media. So it's really hard for me as an individual to make an iPhone, for example. Mm-hmm. So there are some limitations on what can be made by kind of individuals or small collectives that maybe don't exist so intensely in the media space, although I'm sure there are plenty of people here who would argue with me on that point. But I think we're at a really interesting time in that space.
So like a long tail for new devices,
yeah,
long tail of electronics.
Absolutely. I think that's a perfect metaphor.
Now, we've got this addiction to new devices. You mentioned the iPhone as the example of our time right now, that there's always a new one coming out. We're addicted to the next flashier, you know, newer, faster thing. Fabian, let me put this question to you. Is there a way we can keep our devices for longer so that we don't have to keep throwing them away and suffering the environmental toll?
So I think we have like two conflicting forces. The one is, especially to phones, a very intimate and close relationship. People are really close with their phones. They don't leave the house without it. They feel naked without it. But then again, they are so like drawn to the new phone, even though they were so close with the old one. Do you guys keep your old phones, actually? No, you don't, right? No. You do? Okay, yeah. Some do, yeah. Which is interesting. And with the living phone we explored, which kind of exaggerates that relationship of being with another being, we saw that, I mean, people get like, I want to take care of it. It kind of draws on the instinct to take care of a living being. Mm. I'm not sure if that, I mean, increasing the emotional value is surely something that could help us to keep things longer, maybe recycle them, Leah? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we've got this, in days in the past, like a pocket watch could be an object, a precious object that would get passed down from generation to generation.
Right. Yeah.
But the technology didn't need to change in order to keep up with new apps for the pocket watch. So are you suggesting maybe there's kind of a hybrid where parts of the phone might be the precious part and other parts could be swapped out?
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leah, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think, so getting back to maybe the DIY and kind of craft space to think about this question, I think individuals and small groups of people are positioned to do things that large companies can't or don't want to do. And so some of the things that they can do are work with unusual materials, and we have different kinds of relationships with maybe wood and ceramics and glass than we do with plastic and metal. So that is one path to kind of endowing devices with a deeper meaning and kind of changing our relationships with devices. Another thing that individuals can do that large companies can't is that they can work with recycled components. They can go to a junkyard and repurpose materials and kind of take things apart and put them back together and build kind of hybrid devices that have less of an impact environmentally but in a different way. So I think we will start to see emerging from these kind of community-driven efforts some answers to these questions.
Well, one thought that comes to mind is building a physical product has more risk than building a virtual product because of the cost of materials and manufacturing. But I think it's interesting to see things like Kickstarter arriving on the scene, which essentially de-risk the proposition of making a new thing because you can gauge the demand for it before you actually commit the resources to building it. And in fact, Kickstarter, you know, the money from it will help you build the thing. So that's been something that's interesting to watch, like as part of a larger movement of it's basically getting cheaper and getting easier to build physically embodied systems, to build new products that are physical. And I think a lot of that has to do with the mobile phone industry just exploding and bringing the cost of components down, bringing the availability up. There's a lot more manufacturing partners to work with now, and it's easier than ever to work with them. But I think it's still not quite there. I mean, from my experience, manufacturing a physical consumer electronics product, there's still a lot of effort and pain and trips overseas to make something that's really good. So I'm kind of curious for this more DIY model, are there new ways to manufacture that you see as being really important to that?
Absolutely. I mean, so one huge force driving changes in this space is personal manufacturing devices. So some of the machines that I mentioned in my presentation, so 3D printers and laser cutters, are enabling people to manufacture things and stuff that they just couldn't before. Similarly, there are web services that you can access that let you do physical stuff that you just couldn't do very easily before. So those are rapidly driving change in the physical manufacturing space. Another set of forces is just the internet and how cheap it is to go online and sell stuff and kind of have access to a worldwide marketplace. So here in this space, I mean, services like Etsy, for example, are really compelling. And then finally, I would say that another thing that's really interesting about the DIY space is that you don't have to be a company. Manufacturing a device doesn't have to be your full-time job or the primary way that you make a living. This might be, you might make one of something or three of something and sell it on Etsy. And that's an interesting and compelling contribution. So just the way we think about how devices are designed and distributed can shift to encompass kind of hobbyists, pseudo amateurs, all the way up to the large scale manufacturing. So we can now have a really, really long tail with lots and lots of diversity.
Now, I want to talk for a minute about just who we are as people and how our technology impacts that. If there's a great talk that Sherry Turkle gave at a TEDx. If you guys haven't seen it, check it out. Where basically the message is that people are spending a lot more time with their devices to the detriment of their relationships with each other. We basically get addicted to our interactions with technology. So I will pose this to Fabian. How can the way we design devices change this or help this problem get better?
I'm not sure if there's a technical solution for that. I mean, I'm on an information diet right now, so I don't do any email before 5:30 in the afternoon, which makes me very productive. I can only recommend trying that. No social media, no Twitter. So it's like being, I mean, we are really addicted to relevant information from our friends, and if that's a drug, Facebook is our dealer, and it's doing a really good job on delivering excellent, relevant information. The question is, how do we deal with it? Technology-wise, I'm much fascinated with like ambient displays that like live in the background and give you a feeling of what's going on, but not distracting too much of your attention. And you don't have to understand it. You can just feel it, which is what I like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leah, any thoughts?
I'm also not sure I have the answers to these problems. I mean, these are certainly problems that, like Fabian, and I struggle with personally, kind of how to manage my attention and my time. Just to perhaps share another anecdote, a colleague of mine who probably at least some of you are familiar with her work, Dana Boyd, last year went on an email sabbatical where she just had all of the emails that were sent to her email address went directly into the trash. And you were notified that your email had gone into the trash and that she would be away from email for an entire month. And there was just no way to contact her over email. And I thought that was another really interesting way to kind of make space for yourself and to carve away kind of time that let you escape from the kind of insanity of the demands of the digital universe. But I do think that these are some of the toughest challenges that we're faced with as technology designers today.
Do you have another anecdote with a living mobile phone that had a heartbeat all the time? We asked people to wear it over the weekend, and they had all the time the phone beating in their pockets, basically. And they got used to it, which is interesting. But when they had to like take it out in the evening, something was missing. It's like, where is like leaving the house without the wallet? Something is missing, and it's like a gap that comes up, which is, I don't know, I'm not sure if that's a development that we want to see in the future. We did have one emergency doctor, I remember. He liked it because he usually had to check every 5 minutes. Oh, is it not off? Is it not no reception? And he liked knowing, like having a body sense for I'm online, but I'm not sure if that's the general trend we want.
So
that's a question.
We will be opening it up to questions in just a minute. I want to have one more question for me, and then we'll open it up to all of you. Question, and I'll answer first, but I want to know, like, how will... We're all on a mission in a different direction here, working on what we work on. How will we know if we've succeeded? And I'm going to say, for me, with Siftio Cubes, you know, I will know if they become ubiquitous. They truly do become, like... Mark Weiser's vision of a scale of computing that is just good for people, and so they're everywhere. You know, I'm inspired by classic play patterns, so to me, a deck of cards is the most successful game system of all time. You know, they're everywhere, people know what they are. There's a lot of imagination involved in the play, but they are very physical, and you can use them for a lot of different things. So I'd say that's how I'll know if it worked. What do you guys think? Leah?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd make two points, maybe targeting, on the one hand, materials and materiality, on the other, kind of democratization. So on the first point, I would really love to see just a broadening and a diversification of the material landscape of technology. And coupled with that is a broadening and diversification of kind of the aesthetics of technology and the interactions that we have with technology. On the second front, I'd like to see lots of people and lots of different kinds of people feeling like they can make technology for themselves, like it's something that they know how to do and are able to do and are actively out there kind of participating in. So more and larger communities of diverse people actually constructing and designing and building electronics and computational devices.
I would say if we achieve it, that it's not humans that get more technical, but technology gets more human. That would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. I want that too.
That's fine. Yeah.
Well, let's open it up for questions. There's a microphone in the aisle, so if you have a question, please use it.
Hi, my name is Nina. It's a great panel. This has been really interesting. I like the parallel that you guys drew to the media and how it's become something that's extremely personalized and anyone can create it. I remember when I was really little creating my first birthday card on Photoshop on my Apple IIe to give to my mom. And kind of like a lot of these large companies over the last 20, 30 years have, you know, provided better software, provided better printers, provided better materials in order for it to be kind of adopted by the masses. So it's not just a niche market. I want to know, like, who do you think are going to be the key players in order to, like, make that happen in terms of, like, printing for the physical world, 3D printing? Like, who's going to be the ones that are going to be making the software for the masses and, you know, the hardware to get us started?
So I can at least start to answer that question. And I think that's a wonderful and really important question. Certainly device manufacturers are really important in that landscape. So, you know, companies that are producing 3D printers and laser cutters and devices like this are tremendously important. I think equally important are software platforms that allow people to collaborate and share designs and artifacts and communicate around what they're building. Kind of communities and events like Maker Faire also tremendously important. So I think there are lots of pieces to this puzzle, and we're seeing enormous growth in these landscapes, but both, I think, the community side, the software side, and the physical kind of device side are probably equally important.
I would say as an example that MakerBot is one of these companies that is really interesting, and disclaimer, we have some of the same investors, so just wanted to put that out there, but basically it's interesting to see how, as a newcomer in the space that had established companies that make 3D printers and have been doing that for a long time, they have become the darling, at least in kind of our community of makers and researchers and people that are kind of the new generation of making stuff. Mm-hmm. And they've also coupled it with a way to find designs that you want, and this community sharing aspect in their Thingiverse service. So that's kind of, to me, that's the example that pops to my mind to answer your question.
What I would say, maybe very short, is if it was previously those who made the products who like made innovation go, maybe in the next generation is it those who make the tools to get ideas out in the world, like Kickstarter, MakerBot, YouTube is fantastic for sharing ideas.
Yeah,
they are the big players, maybe.
Yeah, all enabled by the internet.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for presenting your ideas and your work. But being in the space, it's interesting to see. Okay. The goal of all this stuff is to have it connected. Once you connect something, you're going to run into FCC. For example, your work on the wall. It's a great concept. It's a great idea. How do you kind of empower the masses? You know, I come from a company. We have a budget, and we can kind of cross those barriers. But how do you allow everyday citizens to kind of say, you know, if you're going to put a circuit board on a wall that wirelessly communicates to a, you know, outside source, you're going to run into FCC certifications, UL listings, all this stuff. How do you see that as, I mean, obviously it's an inhibition into the market, but, you know, is there a better solution to that? And then, you know, across the pond I don't know what it's like over there in regards to that. I imagine there's just as much regulation, if not more. But just if you guys could comment on that, and, you know, thanks again.
Well, I can say from the point of view of having, from building products that do have a wireless in them, we definitely have to pass certification, they have to pass the FCC tests. One of the things that makes it easier, though, is modules that are already certified. So if you use a radio module that's already certified, then you're all set. So I think that for the long tail of people making their own stuff, I'd say, As there's a growing demand for that kind of activity, there will be a growing supply of modules that don't need to be certified because they are already.
Okay.
Just a quick addition to that. I think there are some interesting kind of gray area of products that can be exploited as well. So probably at least some of you are familiar with the company SparkFun Electronics. They produce... What they produce is categorized as kind of kit pieces, and those avoid all of most of the kind of regulatory disaster land that a fully finished product encounters. So there are gray boundaries between what's a product and what's like a tool for designers and hobbyists, and I think there are some interesting little ways that you can get under some of these requirements, although...
So does that mean if it's a kit, it doesn't have to be certified?
It's certified in a much lighter weight way. So if you're selling bare electrical components, your things are much less onerous for you on that, the regulatory side of things.
So if we made people put the circuit board in themselves, then
exactly.
I wouldn't have had to certify this?
Exactly.
That's a battery count.
Good to know.
Yeah.
For future reference.
They manufactured it, yeah.
Fabian, you had kind of alluded to this idea that of when you're creating physical and digital, or stuff that's, you know, both kind of physical and digital, you have to think about, you know, we're just now kind of starting to understand this kind of nuance between cool and creepy.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, when I was growing up, I, you know, always kind of wondered, you know, why we never paid enough attention to, or like there was not a lot of research interest in understanding puppies and animals, et cetera. And now we're starting to see people trying to understand that difference between cool and creepy are now more, you know, researchers and designers alike kind of interested in, how do we interact with cute animals, basically. And
yeah.
So I asked the question, I guess, you know, there's that route. Are there other kinds of things that you kind of turn to when thinking about how to explore that difference and how to really understand the difference between cool and creepy?
Mm-hmm. So may I rephrase your question? It's like, how do we get from creepy to cool? Ideally,
yeah.
I think cuteness helps. That's what I experience. I mean, that's the uncanny valley. I'm sure many of you know it in robots. If they look like fake humans but sick in a way, we find it creepy. It's also very intense, of course. I think cuteness helps. People like the living mobile phone. Most people find it cute because it's like very reduced zoomorph animism, and you give it a pat on the back. It's very reduced as well, and also subtlety. I think if it's very very direct, people will not buy it. It has to be subtle and well designed. But it's a touchy design space. Yeah. Does that help you? Okay.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
It's a complicated question, obviously.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you for your speeches. I have a question for Fabian. What will determine which one of the prototypes that you showed us would be worth pursuing for commercialization in the future?
So I didn't hear, is it what will be
what
a product?
What will determine what's worth commercializing based on everything you've...
I mean, I'm industry funded, so they have to decide, of course. My hunch would be that the weight shifting one is the most feasible one, because they have the battery in the phone anyway and you could motorize it. But it's all research and I don't know actually. My hunch would be that weight shift could be the next thing, because it's very subtle, mechanically quite elegant, and you could even create energy with it, because if something moves in the device, like a watch, that creates energy itself. Just
Thanks.
A hunch, though. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for a great presentation. I have a comment which I would like you to comment on, if you don't mind. You mentioned the availability of tools and new materials. What do you say about the availability of embedded technology, of processors, of them becoming friendlier, of them engaging more programmers from old desktop industry to program for new devices? Do you see that as a trend?
Could you say that last part again? I didn't quite get it.
Are you seeing that as a trend of embedded technology becoming more human?
Becoming more feeling?
Human.
Oh, human.
And available for people to program for it.
So I think I understand what you're asking, but stop me if I'm getting off track. My answer would be absolutely. I mean, the Arduino platform in the last, five or so years has been an incredible development in that space, and I think engaged lots of people in technology development who weren't before, in a combination of it being really cheap, open source, and then spectacularly kind of documented online and having some of that documentation embedded in the tool itself has led to this growth of a community that is now, I think, kind of self-sustaining and even snowballing. So I think that is just a wonderful and inspiring example of what technology looks like in this new kind of media landscape. And I think that's only the tip of the iceberg. So absolutely, I would say yes is the answer to your question.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I think there's a gap, though, which is still not quite bridged between the tools that are getting friendlier, definitely like Arduino, and then what people actually do when they're creating a high-volume consumer electronic product. Mm. I would say in most cases you go and look for something even cheaper. Like the Arduino is cheap, but it's not as cheap as some chip you've never heard of that's made in Taiwan. So there's still this dynamic, I think, of the DIY tools are where people start, and they're easy. They're becoming more accessible. People learn with them. They even build prototypes and build working systems with them. But when something needs to transition into really high volume, then it kind of gets remade. It gets rewritten with a different architecture for extremely low cost. So I would like to see those two, that gap disappear, because then it would make it even easier to go directly from prototype to product.
Oh, that's a great comment. Thanks a lot. I've never thought of that gap between manufacturing and prototyping.
Actually, fritzing is the thing that tries to close the gap. Mm-hmm. Fritzing is like a software. You have a virtual Arduino, virtual breadboard. You like virtually recreate what you have done on the table, and it gives you a PCB layout, and you can have it edged. And
Thank you. Thanks again, guys. This is a fantastic topic, obviously, and super broad, so it's very hard to narrow it in some corridors. But I had a question that I think it's more related to a comment that was made about to turning tech into human, making tech more human. Do you think that that's going to make interfaces that are going to get us closer to people in real relationship, or are going to get us even further away from them?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting question. So we already let the phones getting very, very close to us. It's like really, really close. And I'm not sure where it will lead. I mean, at the same time, you see... trying to rephrase it. Where will it lead? I mean, some things already today, after the Siri interface speaking to the phone is... For me, it's on the edge of creepiness because I don't speak to a human. It's kind of fake thing. I'm not sure.
So is it augmenting our relationship with people, or is it subtracting some elements that are fundamentally ingrained in our humanness?
Yeah. It's interesting because speaking through the phone, you just forget about the phone. It's just talking to that person. And if there's any other, like Skype is a middle thing, you're still aware of Skype. Some people turn off the video because they don't want it. I don't know. It's getting in between, and the question is, how do we like let it vanish and maybe, make it more ready to hand. Yeah.
Okay. So we're basically out of time. Oh. We can do one more quick question, but then I think the three of us can be outside the ballroom afterwards for anybody who wants to stick around and talk more.
Thank you. I don't think my question is going to be that quick.
Okay, well, maybe should we take it after then?
No, the question is quick. I don't know that you can answer it very quickly, but because you used the word creepy too many times, I just couldn't help it. I think it's really cool that we're surrounding ourselves with machines, but we're also developing very good artificial intelligence. I met this guy once who said the war between human and machine has already started. I don't mean to sound too much like I'm a geek or a nerd who reads too many wrong sci-fi novels, but it is true that the machines are kind of beating us in many ways. How do you see that when I, have the machine all around me and we're helping develop those interfaces, suddenly the machines can do things without us and make decisions without us, and the drones can kill people without us having an opinion about it and, decide to not feed the plant without us having an opinion about it. So I'm just wondering if you think about it.
And let's do one sentence responses so we can finish on time. My response is, machines as tools, not as companions.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
I have a very good
response, but I'm still very skeptical about this notion this narrative about technology, and I'd be really interested to continue the conversation offline, but I just don't buy it. I think we're so far from that yet, despite what many of my illustrious colleagues would say, but I'd be happy to talk about it offline.
I totally agree.
Okay, well, let me thank my co-panelists for being here, and thank you all for coming.